From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Forget I do. More and more Americans are saying I don't or I won't. In this hour, the price we may be paying for dumping marriage. First, new developments around Israel, as yesterday's bombing victims are still mourned. Palestinian President Yasser Arafat said today he is ready to implement an unconditional ceasefire with Israel. Cameron Barr is a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor in Jerusalem. I asked him about the genesis of Arafat's offer and how Israel has responded.
He seems to be saying that he's willing to agree to the ceasefire terms that the U.S. mediator, Anthony Zinni, has put before him, which is different from, for instance, going on TV and in Arabic declaring a ceasefire. The Israelis have been very cool to this so far. They've said that they've heard it all before, that he said the similar things 50 times. The Americans, at least out of Washington, they're saying that they want to hear exactly what General Zinni tells them about it. So they're basically not saying anything at the moment. It might be a forward step in the sense that I think these are terms that the Palestinians have not agreed to in the discussions of recent days, and now they are agreeing to them. So that might move the Israelis to join in. At the same time, the Israelis are not in a ceasefire mode at the moment. They are very frustrated with both what Zinni has not been able to accomplish in the 2 weeks he's been here, and they're also a bit frustrated with what has been happening in Beirut over the past couple of days, where the summit of the Arab League has been considering a proposal from the Saudi Arabian leader to come up with a comprehensive peace offer where the Arabs would agree to have peaceful relations with Israel if Israel pulls back to the borders it maintained way back in 1967.
And in fact, the Arab summit did agree to the general proposal along those lines.
It did. The problem may be that it wasn't general enough. In order to win unanimous consent from the 22 members of the Arab League, the declaration makes clear that the Israelis will have to accept terms regarding Palestinian refugees that are unacceptable to Israel. And while it was clear that going into this summit, the Arabs were not hoping to appeal to Israel's prime minister, Ariel Sharon, who holds views on a peace settlement that are far, far different from theirs, but they were trying to come up with a vision of a peaceful Middle East that would appeal to the Israeli public and might encourage them to replace their leader with someone who was more inclined to make peace on the terms that the Arabs envisage.
We heard earlier that there was a new flexibility that people were feeling in the language around this right of return or the issue of Palestinian displaced Palestinians either going back to or being compensated for their homes in Israel. Is that not what ultimately came out of the Arab meeting?
Well, the Arab declaration specifies that the right of return should be governed by a UN resolution that was passed in 1948, mm-hmm. Resolution 194. Mm-hmm. That gives the choice to the refugees. It very, very clearly says that it's up to the refugees to decide whether they want to return to their homes, which may be in what is now Israel, or accept compensation. That resolution has never been acceptable to Israel because the fear is that if too many Palestinians come back to areas inside Israel, then Israel ceases to be a Jewish state. And even Israeli leftists don't want to see that happen.
But wasn't there a sense that Saudi Arabia was opening the door to a new openness to negotiation that might mean compensation, might mean something else entirely, something other than an actual physical return?
Well, I think what the Saudis want is different from what's in the Beirut Declaration, which clearly, I mean, I have it in front of me, refers to UN Resolution 194 as the mm-hmm. basis for the refugee issue. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the reasons why the Israelis are ruling it out of hand right now.
So out of all this, we have some disarray in Beirut, less momentum behind the Saudi proposal than many had hoped, this terrible bombing and deaths 20-plus in Israel on the first evening of Passover, Israel preparing to retaliate massively, and now Arafat saying he wants a ceasefire. Is he seen as trying to deflect Israeli retribution or as throwing up his hands and saying, yes, I'm ready to change?
I think the former. I think he's seen as trying to deflect the activities of the Israeli military. The problem for him and also for Israel is that, by and large, Palestinians feel that they are justified in using violence to fight Israeli occupation. And they also feel that they are successful in doing this. They look at Israel today. They look at an Israeli prime minister whose popularity is half of what it was when he came into power a year ago. They see divisions in Israel. There's debate here. even Ariel Sharon's own security officials criticize, anonymously it's true, but they criticize quite sharply his tactics. There are something like 300 military reservists who have signed a letter refusing to serve in the Palestinian territories. And they look at all this and say that their tactics, including terrorism, are effective and that all they need to do is keep up with it. And that's what Hamas spokesmen were saying today, that we're going on with this, one of them told me, because we are still under occupation. And until these groups, and it's not just the really hardcore extremists, but even, you know, the mainstream Fatah organization, its armed wing, the Al-Aqsa Brigades, has really been responsible for much of the violence of the past weeks and months. Until these Palestinians see an end to occupation in clear-cut terms, I don't think that they see any reason to stop what they're doing.
Cameron Barr is a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor in Jerusalem. Love may be a many-splendored thing, but what about marriage? Is it still relevant? Our guest tonight says yes, and in a big way. And maybe the message is catching. State governments and the Bush administration are vowing to do something about promoting marriage. In Oklahoma, Governor Frank Keating has launched a $10 million marriage initiative, and smaller-scale initiatives are being enacted in other states. President Bush talked up the importance of marriage in a policy speech last month at a Catholic church in Washington.
Statistics tell us that children from two-parent families are less likely to end up in poverty, drop out of school, become addicted to drugs, have a child out of wedlock, suffer abuse, or become a violent criminal and end up in prison. Building and preserving families are not always possible. I recognize that. But they should always be our goal. So my administration will give unprecedented support to strengthening marriages.
With sky-high divorce rates, a boom in single mothers, and increased unwed cohabitation, would America be better off if marriage made a comeback? In his new book, The Marriage Problem, social scientist and former Harvard and UCLA professor James Q. Wilson makes the case that our casual attitude toward marriage has weakened families and our society is paying a terrible price. Is any marriage better than no marriage at all if children are involved? What's your experience as a single parent or as a child raised by one? Do you feel like the problem? What should society's role be in promoting marriage? You can join the conversation this evening at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined from Malibu, California by James Q. Wilson. He's Ronald Reagan Professor of Public Policy at Pepperdine University and author of The Marriage Problem, How Our Culture Has Weakened Our Families. Good evening and welcome, James Wilson.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. And with us from Vermont Public Radio is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Good evening and hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to Professor Wilson.
Hi.
James Wilson, you've written a book in your usual style that is provocative and it gets right down to the short hairs. You make the case that the breakdown of marriage that's taken place now over decades in the United States is the fundamental problem facing this country, that it's led to a corrosion of our cultural soul. Make that case for us.
Well, I think that scarcely any serious social scientist now doubts that children raised in single-parent families, though some mothers do well, especially if they're affluent, are at the root of high rates of delinquency and crime and gang involvement. Lacking fathers in their homes, lacking fathers in their neighborhoods, they have no adequate parental care, they lack a male role model, and they enter into a community in which fathers are not present, so either the order is maintained either by gangs or the police, and neither one is a very attractive alternative. The problem is, first, how did this happen? And secondly, what, if anything, can we do about it? I think I have some answers to the first question. I'm not certain I have any answers to the second question.
Well, tell us what we've learned, because, of course, it's been many years now since this trend began. And even in the 60s, which perhaps was the beginning of the trend, you tell us, but there was always strong kickback from conservative American corners saying this is wrong, 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 wrong. What's the new insight that you bring in this study of marriage and its difficulties?
I'm not sure I bring a new insight. My work is not based on original research, but on sorting through and compiling and reflecting upon the research of others.
Mm-hmm.
I think perhaps one of the most definitive studies was that by Sarah McClanahan and Gary Sandifer, when they analyzed four large longitudinal studies in which people in the United States have been followed since the early 1970s, and interviewers have recorded on an annual basis everything that happens to them. And from that evidence, they are able to show rather clearly in their book from the Harvard Press that even after you hold income constant, children in single-parent families, especially boys, are more likely to be idle, more likely to be delinquent, more likely to have trouble in school. Deborah Dawson from the Department of Health and Human Services published the results of a survey of some 30,000 American families and was able to show that with respect to all ethnic groups, children in single-parent families, except those where the mother earned at least $50,000 a year, were more likely to have the same problem. So that putting this all together, it seems to me the case for marriage, as well as for other social solutions to other social problems, is quite compelling. My argument in the book is that this problem did not begin clearly in the 1960s. That is to say, the 1960s may have contributed to it by the expansion of people searching for personal options, but the root of it began at least a century earlier with the rise and spread of a concept of individualism that equipped people with a belief that since human reason could understand human nature, human reason could select any kind of collective activity it wished, and therefore people could choose into marriage or choose out of marriage with no consequences. My view is that the options exist, the options in American and Western life are desirable, but people have to think of consequences as well as options.
You trace it back to slavery and the Enlightenment. We're going to come to that, but tell us first, where have these, in your view, where have these origins of this brought us today? What's the snapshot of the state of marriage in the United States today?
Well, I think the snapshot of the state of marriage is that about a third of the children in the United States are being raised by single parents. And this is an enormous burden on them. The numbers have steadily risen since the early 1960s. They flattened out a bit in the year 2000. Some people believe that maybe the cycle has been reversed, but I think the decline is so small that we can't be confident of that reversal yet.
And the percentage of Americans, the portion of Americans who turn to marriage when they want to be together?
I beg your pardon?
The portion of Americans who embrace marriage now?
In time, virtually everyone gets married by the time they're 60 years old. But at the marriage ages, when children are likely to be produced, in your late teens, in the 20s and 30s, the proportion of women who get married at all and the portion of men who get married at all has dropped dramatically over the last 40 or so years.
Mm-hmm. Jack Beatty, James Wilson is pointing up a critique that in very general terms you've heard for a long time, but he's saying, look, the evidence is there now. This is corrosive, not just of children's lives, but of the nation's cultural soul. Your take?
Well, it's sort of passing strange that one has to write a book to say this. I mean, this would have been the common wisdom, I should think, for most generations, that families were mothers and fathers together, that children, especially boys, needed the influence of a father. We published an important paper by Barbara Defoe White at We, the Atlantic Monthly, 10 years ago, in which she showed a graph where two lines crossed, and one was the line of mortality, that up until the mid-1970s, the main source of a child being left without a parent was mortality. In the 80s, divorce crossed death. So it was a historic change, and the insecurity that creates for children, I just don't think is disputable. Now, of course, people have disputed it, and there are other books that say that it's not as bad, but it's a matter of saying it's not as bad.
James Wilson says it's not just bad, it is destroying the country from the bottom up. What do you think? Does America have a marriage problem? Does the decline in marriage equal the decline of American civilization? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We will be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with our guest tonight, author James Q. Wilson, about his framing of the marriage problem, the notion that the deterioration, the diminishment of the central place of marriage in American life is leading, has led to a profound corrosion of America's cultural soul. What do you think? Are Americans living outside the traditional family somehow damaged goods? Is there a corrosion at the heart of America's cultural soul? Is the decline of marriage the problem? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined from California by James Wilson. He's author of The Marriage Problem, How Our Culture Has Weakened Families. James Wilson, you say that the origins of the slide of marriage are not really in the 60s. You tie the slide back to two things: slavery, which you say weakened families, and the Enlightenment, which you say made people think that families were unimportant. Please walk us through those.
All right, I will. But first, let me make a comment about what Jack Beatty said before the break.
Sure.
I'm immensely proud of the fact that the Atlantic Monthly published that famous article by Barbara Defoe Whitehead, which was accurate then and is more accurate now. But remember,
the gist of that was, for those of us who haven't read it again,
Well, I'll give you the gist by citing the title, which shows how controversial it was. The title of the article was "Dan Quayle Was Right." She was defending Dan Quayle's speech in which he attacked Murphy Brown for being a single mother.
Right, of course.
Now, if only 10 years ago, intellectual and literary figures thought those views were controversial, it's clear that you can't publish enough about this and to try to make the case that this is a very important business.
Well, and your book lands at a time when this is not just a social issue but a public policy issue. So we're glad to be talking about it.
Back to the two issues. There's two things that have to be explained. One is, why has marriage become so much less common throughout the English-speaking world, United States, Australia, Canada, and New Zealand? Why has it become less common in France and Scandinavia, but still quite common in the Mediterranean areas, still quite common in the Middle East, still quite common in the Far East?
What's your answer?
The answer is that Western culture produced an extraordinary invention which has benefited all of us enormously, the Enlightenment. That is to say, the liberation of human reason from ancient prescriptions, monarchical decrees, crusty history. And by doing that, it's brought about free markets and political liberty and democratic government. And in fact, the United States of America is a country founded on the Enlightenment. But every culture has a cost, and the cost that we paid for the Enlightenment was to make people believe slowly over the centuries that human reason could solve any problem of human nature.
We didn't need all that old traditional baggage.
That's right. And since marriage was a cultural invention, it's not programmed for us by evolutionary biology. Marriage was a cultural invention enforced by religion, laws, customs, decrees, and the like.
And the slavery piece?
And the slavery piece is trying to show why Black Americans, like African Americans in Jamaica and Barbados and Antigua and Brazil and wherever you look that race slavery existed, have so much higher a level of single-parent families. And the answer to that is that one of the great failings of the United States and many other countries was to practice slavery. And in that time, marriage was illegal. On small plantations, a couple living together could be easily separated at the auction block. And so we had 2.5 centuries of people growing up with no sense of what a marriage was, why a mother and a father were bound together by law and religion. And so, as in the Jim Crow period and in continuing to the present, slavery helps explain why Black Americans have this problem more than white Americans, though white Americans are working very hard to catch up.
You almost describe how these two veins intertwine, intersect. You say we're left today with two nations, both of which are sidling away or faster than that from marriage. One advantaged, educated, affluent, the other not so. You say there's a second nation growing more rapidly than the first. It is the nation that has paid heavily the high price of freedom. It is armed to the teeth, excited by drugs, preoccupied with respect, and indifferent to the future. You say the first nation tries to hide from the second behind guarded gates or in protected apartments. In a modern society, you can run, but you can't hide. James Wilson, are you trying to scare affluent America back into line here?
I'm trying to point out that the principles of the Enlightenment and the principles of modern democratic thought, desirable as they are, have undercut a traditional commitment to marriage, which affluent people can often manage to handle. They have psychiatrists, they have counselors, they have programs, they have educational systems. And when those views are passed on to people who are not affluent, who don't have access to psychiatrists and counselors and special education programs, the results can be very severe. And that affluent Americans have to face up to the fact, as I think they already have, that we have this problem in the country, and help support voluntary as well as some governmental efforts to try to rebuild marriage for everyone and re-sanctify, so to speak, not in a religious sense, but re-sanctify in a secular sense.
But you seem to be saying just because you're living high on the hog, don't think you can walk away from tradition. If you do, it will all come back to bite you, if not through your neighbor, then from someone on the other side of the tracks.
Well, in Los Angeles, near where I live, we have an estimated 180,000 young men in gangs, and the murder rate only goes out down when the gangs decide to declare a temporary truce. The truce hasn't lasted, so the murder rate's going back up in Los Angeles. And everyone knows this, so they move to the suburbs or guarded condominiums and pretend the other world doesn't exist. But the other world, statistically, is growing faster than they are.
Jack Beatty, James Q. Wilson is saying to everyone, rich and poor, hey, get in line for your own good.
Yeah, he certainly is, and that's a frightening thought. Just the thought of the sheer number of men in gangs. I wonder, though. I unfortunately, Professor Wilson, I haven't had a chance to read your book, just your articles about it. But I wonder if you get at capitalism there, particularly at the sort of regime effect of the kind of capitalism we have, which is consumer capitalism, which depends on arousing boundary stretching desires. In fact, if we started to remoralize in our society, it could well take the form of purchasing less. It would certainly take the form of wanting less, and I do think that is a I think it's been called the cultural contradictions of capitalism, that we have a system that depends upon always just making us want more than we can have, and it's a system that's saturated with sexualized entertainment and advertising, and all of this keeps desire forever on the boil and makes content harder and harder for people to find. Haven't we kind of evolved an economy, really, of what you might call uncommitment or desire?
Well, we may have evolved such an economy. I know the phrase the cultural contradictions of capitalism, but the same argument can be made about free speech, free press, which don't crucially depend on capitalism. They are political constructs, and they also enable us to celebrate our immediate desires. Capitalism is not what produces consumerism on television. What produces consumerism on television is that people like it. And unless you control the press, which I think is a monstrous idea, people will like MTV and VH1 and the constant celebrations of a partially slightly clad women celebrating spring break in Cancun with a bunch of eager guys pawing at them. Now, that's an anti-marriage message. It's a pro-adolescent marriage. It fits with my adolescent sentiments when I was a young man growing up in Southern California. Had I but known that someday all of my fantasies would have been on television, I would have been startled. But it goes over because people act on immediate instincts, and they do not often sit down and think about the long-term consequences of their actions.
And James Wilson is calling for a turn in that trend, for new social and cultural pressures to reassert the place of marriage in our society. James Wilson, Jack Beatty, let's turn to the phones. Lori is on the line. Welcome, Lori. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Great subject.
Thanks.
I just want to make a couple of comments. One, I think, is a married couple somehow second rate if they don't have children. Two, I think a lot of it is women nowadays don't have to be married. It used to be in times, you know, you had to get married. Somebody else.
In which respect, biological or social, are you thinking, Lori?
Well, basically, they had to have somebody provide for them.
I see. Mm-hmm.
They had to, you know, they were looked upon. Looked down upon if they left the family and went off on their own. They had to, you know, find a man and get married and produce. That isn't the case anymore. And third, probably the biggest thing for me is the financial, I don't want to say strains, but I've been married for 3 years. I came from actually a divorced family. Mm-hmm. My parents divorced when I was like three, I think. Mm-hmm. And I've been married for 3 years, and the only thing we ever have disagreements about usually is money. And this year I have to pay over $500 in taxes because I'm married. I've never had to pay taxes before. I've always got a refund. Mm-hmm. It seems you're penalized more. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you get tax breaks.
Of course. Yeah, yeah. We know the argument. Lori, thanks for your call. You've laid out quite a smorgasbord there. But I guess, James Wilson, let's jump in first on the liberated place of women in American society. You talk throughout the book about reasserting the authority of marriage. Now, to some women, that will sound like reasserting the authority of the patriarchy.
Yes,
is there a difference?
I certainly don't mean it to sound that way. And in many places, though, from the point of view of a critical reader, probably not enough places, I try to say, look, I think the emancipation of women is one of the great accomplishments of the last century. There's more to be done, but an enormous amount has been achieved, and I wouldn't turn back any of those gains at all. You can have emancipated women who choose marriage and family for the right reasons, or you can have emancipated women who reject marriage and family for what I regard as bad reasons. The solution is not to oppress women. The solution, it seems to me, is to make the choices clearer and the consequences clearer so that women will make choices they can live with. And as
and yet without the pressure of financial need, isn't that part of what gives leeway to people, to women, to say, hey, I don't need marriage?
Of course. And what you could add to the fact that women now earn a lot of money, the fact of birth control and abortion and contraception, all of these things make it easier to separate your sexual life from marriage or to decide that you will acquire a child by adoption or by a fertilization from a man who you do not plan to marry. All of these things are true. Women face vastly more choices. I'm not trying to restrict their choices. I'm simply trying to say, look, use those choice powers you have wisely. Don't say that your money, your birth control pills, your access to abortion, the fact that you may not think you need a man to live with, determine how you raise a child, because how you raise a child really depends upon marriage.
We're going to turn now to Theodore Ooms. She's senior policy analyst at the Center for Law and Social Policy in Washington, D.C. Her article entitled Marriage Plus appears in the current issue of the American Prospect. Good evening and welcome, Theodora Ooms.
Good evening. I'm glad to be with you.
Thanks for being with us. I know you've been listening in. What do you make of James Q. Wilson's critique of the state of American marriage and his prescription of returning more authority to marriage?
Well, I'm really thrilled that a man of Professor Wilson's distinction is addressing this issue. I have to confess I have yet to read his book. I've ordered it, and I've read a little bit of what he's written.
So it'll grab you. It will grab you.
At the drift. I think his sense that this is a problem, I would definitely agree with. I don't want to get into a discussion at this point about the causes of the problem without reading his book. I think we would all agree that they go deep and there are many different causes. I think what is great about this discussion, however, is to focus on the fact that instead of treating this as the M word, which we've been doing for decades, now we can begin to discuss not only what are the causes of the problem, but what can we do about it.
What turned marriage into the M word, Theodora Ooms?
I think because it's a very sensitive subject. People have been worried that if you start talking about how marriage is better for kids, all these people who are single parents will start feeling guilty, start feel blamed. There are a whole host of reasons, but I think, and that's a real challenge, how can you promote marriage without saying to single people who, for a variety of reasons, don't happen to be married or single parents, without making them feel bad. Mm-hmm. But I think we're getting a little bit beyond that now and saying if you focus on what children need, most people will agree that children do better in two-parent married families, although some, as Professor Wilson says, many children of single parents do fine. The risks are greater if you're being raised in a single-parent family. family. It's much harder job to do.
But it's not easy just to go back to marriage, is it? You've written about policy proposals that hint at coercing people to marry, reinforcing Victorian conceptions of gender roles, limiting the right to end bad marriages, hidden agendas that threaten to put women back
right.
in the kitchen, ignore domestic violence, eliminate public assistance for low-income families. Is this all of a package? Are we sophisticated today, now that the M word is back out in the open,
right.
to pull these things apart and deal with it constructively?
Well, I think we've started the discussion. You've just outlined a number of the fears that people have, especially when you talk about government getting involved in this area. They are afraid that maybe government will force or coerce or bribe people into marriage. I've been watching what people are doing around the country, and I am working actually as a consultant in Oklahoma and a couple of other communities where people have come together to say, what can we in our own sphere do to try to help more children grow up in two-parent families? And I think the exciting thing is that all the surveys show that most Americans still highly value marriage, want to marry, and want that marriage to last. So you have that deep desire to build on. But now we can begin to talk about what is it can we do? And I think there are a number of things we can do, which I mentioned in the article. And
Give us a couple that we can do.
Well, I think there are some things we can do about removing some of the penalties that a lot of that your caller called in about.
Yes.
And that's partly a signal, as well as it may have some effect, though I agree with Professor Wilson that I don't think economic disincentives to marriage are really a primary reason.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a great deal we can do in the way of educating young people about what marriage is. I think we now know a lot about what makes marriages succeed. Now that we no longer have the social constraints that kind of glue people to stay in a marriage even when it's a bad marriage,
mm-hmm.
we have to help people learn how to make relationships work, to hang in there in the bad times because there are going to be some difficult times.
I want to ask James Wilson, you're the Ronald Reagan professor of public policy at Pepperdine. Theodore Ooms is writing in the Liberal American Prospect, and I hear very similar themes coming here. Is this a new kind of culture shock?
I'm a long-time admirer of Ms. Ooms. She's contributed powerfully to this whole subject. I don't think this ought not to be a subject where ideology matters, and the fact that I'm called a Ronald Reagan professor doesn't mean anything about what I'm writing. For all I know, she's the Al Gore professor of something else. But
I'm jiving you a little bit, but you know what I mean.
This is not the ideology that arises comes, I think, from people who are fearful that by emphasizing marriage, we're going to do something bad to women. And I think she and I agree that the goal is not to change the status of women. The goal is to get people, men and women alike, to make the right choices. And I was delighted to learn that she's working with the Oklahoma Project. I think that's the way to do it. Have neighborhood meetings. View this as a cultural problem. Try to get people to think of imaginative ways to encourage marriage.
We've got to take a short break. Theodore Ooms,
I want to pick up on that in a minute.
We'll have to come back and catch that. We're talking about the state of marriage in America and the argument that we need a whole lot more marriage than we've got. Is there a corrosion at the heart of America's cultural soul? Is the decline of marriage the problem? Are you inspired by James Wilson's message or insulted? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're joined tonight by James Q. Wilson, author of the new book, The Marriage Problem, How Our Culture Has Weakened Families, and by Theodora Ooms, senior policy analyst at the Center for Law and Social Policy in Washington, D.C. We're talking about the state of marriage in America today and the impact of what's seen as quite a disheveled state. What do you think? Does the decline in marriage equal the decline of American civilization? Are you ready to restore what James Wilson calls the authority of marriage? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Theodore Ooms, I know we just have you for another minute, but what about James Wilson's assertion here that finally women don't have to worry about this renewed emphasis on marriage? Do you agree?
I think that's correct. But I think there is a lot of common ground between us. But I do think there is an important difference, too. I think progressives, liberals like myself, are more they want to emphasize that economics has a lot to do with the failure to marriage these days, especially in the low-income populations. When young men with low skills don't have jobs, they don't have no woman's going to want to marry them. When people are under great economic stress, that puts a lot of strain and pressure on a relationship and on a marriage. So I think that we have to look at some economic strategies as well.
It's not just about social morality.
No, it's not. I think it has to be both. And in Oklahoma, for example, they are putting a lot of government money into trying to deliver some new services for low-income young couples, whether they're married or not, to help them have a better relationship, to get the jobs that they need. They're doing a lot of things, not just sort of preaching at them or telling the people that they should get married because it's better for children. Mm-hmm. We need to give people that message, but then we have to help them achieve that goal. Mm-hmm. And that will require many different strategies and many different parts of society to work together.
Theodora Ooms, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
It's good to talk to you.
Theodora Ooms is Senior Policy Analyst at the Center for Law and Social Policy in Washington, D.C. Jack Beatty, everybody's holding hands around this issue. It looks like marriage may be on the mend if this reflects the national consensus.
Well, we've come some way from Gloria Steinem's statement years ago that a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle. Of course, Gloria Steinem is married now. A woman may or may not need a man, but children need men and women together. But as the president said, and you began the hour with it, it's not always possible to build families. And I think that's what Theodora Ooms was trying to emphasize here, that the conditions of life, especially unemployment, chronic urban unemployment, depending on bad education and so on, that these create people – It creates a sort of surplus of unmarriageable men who aren't ready for marriage. Mm. And this is a grave sort of social problem, an economic problem, as much as it is a moral one.
James Wilson may be showing us the way out. Let's turn to phones. Rich is on the line. Welcome, Rich. You're on the air.
Hi, fellas. How are you?
We're good, thanks.
I'm from Boston. And back in the 60s, when I was a boy, times were tough. And families are having struggles, so the mothers would go to the agencies to ask for help. And what I recall was the people who administered the help would tell the mothers, we'll give you help, but you have to get your husband out of the house. You have to get a warrant on him and get him out of the house, which indicates to me the government had a direct hand in breaking the family up. The social experiment isn't working now, and now everybody wants to put it back to where it used to be somewhat. It sounds like the laboratory, we're all doing well in the laboratory.
Now, that's an interesting point, Rich. Thanks for making it. James Wilson, what about that? Do you see government policy, welfare policy in particular, as having played a part in the breakup of marriage?
Well, for a long time, scholars profoundly doubted that the old Aid to Families with Dependent Children program had anything to do with this. But I think the best research we now have over the last 10 years shows that, in fact, it did. It didn't cause the problem, but it accelerated the change. This finding comes from studying carefully how young poor women grow up and following them over the years and noticing that depending on the kind of welfare benefits they get in the community, they are more or less likely to get married. So that the old welfare policy did make single-parent families more common. And the Supreme Court of the United States celebrated this in a famous Alabama decision in 1969 in which the state of Alabama tried to deny welfare benefits to a woman who was living with a man, not her husband. And the Supreme Court said, no, the purpose of benefits is to go to children, and we really don't care what the woman does. If she can get married or not, that's not the state of Alabama's business. That was a profound signal throughout the system, and I think the signal needs to be changed that states need to be allowed to encourage marriage among people who would not otherwise be married.
Joe is on the line. Welcome, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I agree somewhat with your guest tonight that marriage is a major problem in this country. But I don't think that it is the reason for the decline of this country. I think it's I think the problem is bigger than that. I think it's a subset. I think that the main problem is the lack of spirituality in this country. And I think if that underlying problem was addressed, then marriages would go up, because in almost every major religion, marriage is a very big part of that.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying a marriage without God or spirituality in your mind is not an answer.
Exactly. I think that if you have a marriage without the spirituality, you're going to end up with a difficult marriage.
Joe, thanks for the call. How about it, James Wilson? Joe really gets to something that you kind of suggest, which is a whole package here. That these aren't dry social experiments. That there's a substructure of values that will support this. You say it won't be government that will ultimately make this happen. It will be churches. It will be neighborhoods. That suggests a kind of lifting up of these values. Do you see all this needing to be as a package?
Well, I do think that has to be a package because, as Ms. Said earlier, there's no simple cause for the breakup of marriage and there's no simple solution. But your last caller is quite right. Statistically, there is no doubt that people who are committed to religion are more likely to get married before they have children and less likely to get divorced. The question we haven't got the answer to is whether by using churches to intervene with people who don't already have those values, you can change those people. And the effort to do that lies at the heart of President Bush's faith-based movement that he and John DeLeo and others were pressing. And it remains to be seen. It's a problem that has to be checked. My view is that getting churches more involved in these matters, getting synagogues more involved in these matters will probably be a benefit, but we don't know yet how large a benefit or how big the cost will be.
We're talking about Ma, Pa, the kids, and God making a comeback in America. Nick is on the line. Welcome, Nick. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to make a point that, for example, in Finland and other European countries, mm-hmm. you have a low rate of marriage, but you still have devoted couples raising children together without being married.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's true. And especially in Finland, you have a very low age for the first birth on average, which is about 24, about 3 to 4 years below the European average.
Now, that's a very interesting point, and I wonder, James Wilson, does that go to Jack Beattie's point about the economic substructure? These are affluent countries. Can all affluent countries afford to ignore marriage and just forge ahead?
This is one of the large unanswered questions. If I ended the book with a list of things we need to know more about, I would put this close to the top of the list. It's not only true of Sweden, it's also true, not only true of Finland, it's also true of Sweden and Norway, that cohabitation is progressing to replace marriage. It hasn't replaced it yet. It's still a minority of the couple relationships, but it's one-third of all Swedish couples cohabit. They're not married. The important thing is that the father and mother are there as cohabiting parents and raise the child jointly. Now, in Sweden and Finland and Norway, these cohabiting couples tend to be higher status people with some education and professional skills. In this country, by and large, on average, cohabiting couples do not have those characteristics. So one of the great puzzles is, why is Sweden able to operate that way, and we can't operate that way? And I don't think anybody really knows the answer to that question.
Nick, any thoughts on that?
Well, I think part of it is the support that is given in the society in terms of social benefits, and which makes it a lot easier to have people in a certain class of affluence to afford to stay together and not marry. And I think part of it is the overall level of affluence.
Mm-hmm. Nick, thanks so much for your call. Karen is on the line. Welcome, Karen. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I'm 25, and I happen to be of the generation where most of my friends' parents were not married.
Mm-hmm. That means they were divorced or they had never been married?
Divorced, mm-hmm. I would say. Mm-hmm. I think divorce is much worse than never been married and cohabiting. My parents met in the eighth grade.
Okay.
Dated in the eighth grade, got married right as soon as they could when they were 19, and have been together forever. They're still together. They're very in love. And I can tell you just from personal experience of friends and that the family unit is very important. Most of my friends had a lot of trouble not having two parents, went through so much. I can't tell you when I was a teenager how many times people would be jealous of me for having parents. It's really a strange phenomenon in this country. I think several of the reasons One is that it's really not a survival unit anymore in this country. It used to be you needed a family to survive or you relied on your family to survive. And now it's sort of just an extra thing, like a television, like you, something you have.
But does it seem like extraneous or just extra to you?
No, not to me because of the way I was raised and because of the wonderful family that I had. But I think to others, there is a sense of that.
We can feel it running right through the conversation tonight.
Yep.
Karen, thanks so much for that call. I want to try and get another call in. Dana's on the line. Welcome, Dana. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just concerned about how this is so defined to be between a man and a woman, having read studies about how it's more important just to have two loving parents involved and not so much that you have one of each gender. And just
so you're bringing up gay marriage,
right.
Dana, or gay couples?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Let's put that to James Wilson. Does it matter, James Wilson, as long as there are two parents and a nurturing family? Does it matter in your mind whether they're the same gender or male-female?
I don't know the answer to the question, and I could not find a substantial literature on it. The number of gay or lesbian couples who have children is very small in the country, and studies have not been done that give you a good insight as to how these children will grow up. So I didn't talk about it in the book, and I didn't talk about it because I think we have a social scientific ignorance about it. I don't have a prejudgment on this question. I do want to go back to the point that Karen made about marrying earlier versus marrying later. It is extremely important. In a chapter in my book, I talk about what I call the sex ratio, the ratio of men to women of a marriageable age in a society. Since men, for reasons that only a biologist can explain, tend to marry younger women, and as the older the man gets, the younger the woman he marries. So 50-year-old men will marry 30-year-old women,
or
23-year-old men will marry 22-year-old women. It means that women's progress has confronted women with a tough choice. I got married right after college. My father got married right after high school. But the chances of a woman finding a man of the right age and the suitable level of education drop dramatically after she turns about 25. And at that age, she's going to find the supply of men so short that she either has to make very tough choices or perhaps no choice at all. This isn't an argument for marrying earlier, because I'm not wanting to tell women don't go to college, but it is an argument that one of the prices you pay for postponing marriage into your 30s is a dramatic reduction in the chance of finding the right mate, especially if you're a woman.
James Wilson, I want to give Jack Beatty a last word here. Jack, it is a fascinating conversation. In so many ways, James Wilson concludes his book saying that we have extinguished shame and achieved illusory emancipation. And I hear tonight, get married younger, stay married longer, fear God. Are we going back or forward, Jack?
Oh, well, I don't know. I mean, I think the issue is what's good for children. Theodore Ohms made that point earlier. And to take the focus off the shame aspect of this and say, you know, what is the best thing for children? And I know children brought up by gay couples who are loving and committed and the children seem to me wonderful. And I think that can happen and all sorts of things are possible. But it takes two and commitment. Just the prospect of bringing up a child alone, I don't know how a single mother ever does that with all the headaches.
And yet there are millions doing it
and
right now.
Heroically.
James Wilson, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
It's been a fascinating discussion, and I particularly enjoyed talking to Jack Beatty and Theodore Ohms.
Well, we're thrilled to have you all here.
James
Q. Wilson is author of the new book, The Marriage Problem, How Our Culture Has Weakened Families. You can read the first chapter of James Wilson's book on our website. Log on to onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is W.